You're listening to the Liberty News Radio Network, and this is the Political Cesspool. The Political Cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program, and here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is the unofficial anthem of England, and welcome to tonight's live broadcast of TPC this Saturday evening, March the 13th. We continue our March Around the World special series after speaking with leaders in the United Kingdom and Australia last week. We're returning to Great Britain this hour before taking a quick trip north of the border to speak with some of our kinsmen up in Canada. Later this month, still stops to make in Croatia, Germany, Scotland, and Sweden. But joining us right now from the mother country, making his debut appearance on TPC, is Peter Rushton. Peter is the deputy editor for Heritage and Destiny magazine and a highly sought-after political commentator, having made appearances on Russia Today, Iran's Press TV, and many other outlets. It's our pleasure to welcome him tonight. Staying up past midnight is Peter Rushton. Peter, how are you?
I'm very well indeed, James, and very pleased to be here.
You do great. You've been placed on hold. Please wait.
Okay, well, we'll find out what that was all about, but we do thank Peter for the kind comment, and we'll have our producer see what's going on there.
Put, in the old days, you'd be an old, have to put a quarter in the...
Well, sometimes when you make these international calls, we'll
or
see.
Shilling.
We'll see what happens. Maybe it was because he didn't. Maybe we had him on hold for too long, and then maybe that happened. But no, listen, we've got Peter back now. Well, we're trying out a new method of connecting with our international guests. But no, Peter, great to have you tonight. This is, as I mentioned, your debut appearance. So by all means, tell us a little bit more about your background. I know it is greatly extensive. For people who aren't familiar with you and your work, you are certainly one of the lions of the UK and one of our movement's elder statesmen over there, highly respected. And, of course, Heritage and Destiny magazine. Tell us more.
Thank you very much, James, and thanks very much for inviting me. You do great work on this show. With H&D, we've just recently celebrated our 100th issue, having been a magazine that started out in the USA back in the 90s and then relocated over here with my colleague Mark Cottrell in 2002, 2003. And we now bring out six issues a year, try to cover a pretty wide range of racial nationalist thought rather than being tied to one particular faction. And things have been going very well for the magazine, especially, as I say, now being up to issue 100. My own background in the cause, as it were, goes back to the late 80s. And for up until 2002, I was in the British National Party, in the BNP, closely aligned to its leader in the 90s, its founder, John Tyndall. I left the BNP in 2002, and as well as H&D, electorally speaking, was involved with other nationalist campaigns, including getting a couple of people elected to a council in 2006 up in one of our racial battlegrounds, I suppose you'd call it, up in the northwest of England. So I've had... quite a range of experience of the movement over here, mainly now as a writer rather than an election campaigner for reasons that we might touch on later on. But who knows, the electoral route might be opening up again in England now for racial nationalists, the way that things are going here.
Well, let's just start right there, Peter, if you don't mind. And this actually circles back to a question we asked of our mutual friend and colleague, Adrian Davis, last week. And it would be a perfect question to begin tonight's line of thought with you. But we know Mark Collett, this age of blacklisting, denial of bank privileges. Is there any real hope for an electoral fight back by our people in Britain? Is there anyone in our circles who has the will and the wit to unite the smaller squabbling nationalist groups? And can there be another breakthrough at the ballot box for our people in the UK?
Well, I think strangely, in what you just mentioned a moment ago, is to some extent a very hopeful sign for us. The very fact that the establishment is so desperate to close people down, so desperate even going down the route of closing down people's bank accounts, which I've had experience of myself as well, bringing people to criminal trial, getting people kicked off the internet, and even now, as of last week, a leading think tank led by a former senior police officer recommending yet further tightenings of our race laws that have been tightened progressively ever since the mid-60s. All of that suggests that the establishment is very, very concerned about the potential, not at this point the actuality, but the potential of racial nationalist groups to get somewhere. And I assume they're thinking, in the first instance at least, getting somewhere via the ballot box or via influencing public opinion in a range of ways. If they weren't concerned about that potential, why would they be so desperate to go to these extraordinary lengths that really trample on what most people would have thought of British traditions of freedom going back centuries? They're prepared to trample on those traditions blatantly, and surely the reason for that is because they're concerned about the potential of our movement.
Okay. This is Keith Alexander, sir. How are you doing? I'm the co-host with James.
I'm very pleased to be speaking to you, Keith.
Well, thank you so much. My mother was an English war bride in World War II, by the way, from Watford. Thought I'd just throw that in for whatever it's worth.
Uh-huh.
Nonetheless, let me ask you this. How bad is racial influx situation in England? I hear, for example, that we're twice as far down the path of no return. We've got a 60% white population. Does England have an 80%? Is that hearsay? Is that false information? What's the situation? I also then hear about entire sections of cities being more or less annexed by foreigners in England. If you address both of those topics for us.
Sure. Well, in terms of the statistics, we are just out in a few weeks' time to have our census that takes place every 10 years. So we'll see exactly what the statistical position is then. Broadly speaking, I think the important...
Peter, apologies. Apologies for the break. Commercial radio is a cruel master, but we do have to take our first of the evening. So ponder on that question, ponder on your answer, and we will continue. We ran out of time too quickly with Adrian last week as he kicked off this special series. We're trying to squeeze in a few extra minutes with you, bringing you on a little early. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I really don't want to talk about this, but I will. I'm just so mad. I didn't get asked to the junior prom, and it's raining, which means by the time I get to school, I'm soaking wet. Dad picked me up just after I left, and I was so mad I got out, and he said, "Wait, your mom said to give you this." I forgot my lunch money, and then I dropped it in the water, and I was late for history, and so at lunchtime, I had to find something on John Stuart Mill, which, of course, our library didn't have, so I had to walk all the way down to the office to call my mom, and she found something on the internet and called me back. And Karen, she wouldn't even help me, and that's a whole nother story. But Dad helped me conjugate nouns or whatever on the way to the swim team workout, and then he read my history paper while I was in the pool, and of course, I forgot the bibliography, so I had to do that with my mother when I got home, and it made me totally forget that I put my jeans in the washer that morning, and I hate it when they sit wet like that all day and smell like mildew, but my mom said she put them in the dryer while I was at the swim team, and, you know, I'm just not going to go to the prom, no matter who asks me. I just want to stay home with my mom and dad.
Family.
And just hang out.
Isn't it about time?
Unless Dustin asks me.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
As you all know, Roe versus Wade has resulted in some of the most permissive abortion laws anywhere in the world. For example, in the United States, it's one of only seven countries to allow elective late-term abortions, along with China, North Korea, and others. Right now, in a number of states, the laws allow a baby to be born from his or her mother's womb in the ninth month. It is wrong. It has to change. Americans are more and more pro-life. You see that all the time. In fact, only 12% of Americans support abortion on demand at any time. Under my administration, we will always defend the very first right in the Declaration of Independence, and that is the right to life.
As a parent, is receiving a faith-based, character-focused education for your children difficult to find? Do you believe that godly principles should be a central component in your child's education? Imagine a school where faith and integrity are at its center, where heritage and responsibility instill character. For over 40 years, American Heritage School has been educating both hearts and minds, bringing out academic excellence. This is the school where character and embracing the providence of a living God are fundamental, where students' national test scores average near the 90th percentile. With American Heritage School's Advanced Distance Education Program, distance is no longer an issue. With an accredited LDS-oriented curriculum from kindergarten through 12th grade, your children can attend from anywhere in the world. American Heritage School will prepare your child for more than a job. It will prepare them for life. To learn more, visit American-Heritage.org. That's American-Heritage.org.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is yet another British anthem, the land of hope and glory, and we are going to be doing that as well this month as we take our march around the world playing some traditionalist classics and hymns from the respective nation from which each of our esteemed guests this month will be appearing. And you're probably asking yourself, well, James, where did you get, how did you know that these were the anthems of these nations? Well, I asked somebody, and the person that I asked over in the UK just so happens to be a mutual friend of both Peter and mine, whose name shall remain nameless. But when I told him that Peter was going to be on this evening, he wrote back to me. Peter is one of the men who puts out the excellent Heritage and Destiny magazine and webpage. By the way, folks, check that out, heritageanddestiny.com. It includes terrific articles on history, politics, and the arts. Peter, this listener and friend writes, is an intelligent, articulate, and dedicated activist. I've had the pleasure of hoisting an adult beverage with him on several occasions. He's an all-rounder, but I'd say his wheelhouse is the history and current state of play of British nationalism. And that is, of course, what we're talking to Peter about thus far. And before the break, Peter, we were talking about the current demographics, the current trends in Britain. And Keith was talking and asking about how some entire cities or sections of cities have been taken over. So let's talk about the Muslims in Britain. During the lockdown, there has been a pause in what we would call the spectacular Islamic terror attacks in Britain. But the Muslim grooming gangs, machete attacks, growth of the Muslim population, and a number of powerful Muslim politicians has continued. Is the normalization of Muslims in Britain sleepwalking? Are people into slow, steady, insidious replacement? Have we become boiled frogs? Or what is the current state of play on that question over there?
Yeah, well, I tend to look at these things more in racial terms rather than in religious terms. But I think COVID showed us, some aspects of the early COVID pandemic showed us what the situation was in some of our major cities in terms of the ethnic minority takeover of those cities. because in the very early stages of the pandemic, for example, Leicester, the city of Leicester, the most multiracial city in England, was a centre of the pandemic. And the reason for this, of course, is that certain groups in Leicester had become accustomed to operating pretty much outside the law in terms of sweatshop labour, in terms of certain sections of the economy that were dominated by certain ethnic minorities that operated pretty much as a law unto themselves. Peter, let me ask you this, if I could. Some of those.
You said you got, this is Keith again. Yeah. Let me just ask you this. You said you prefer to discuss these people in racial and ethnic terms rather than religion. Of course, what do you call the Muslims over there? And are there more than one group of Muslims?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and it's particularly relevant in my own hometown in Oldham, where I went to school, because there are far from Muslims working together to advance their political agenda. There are a vast number of Muslims in Oldham, but they're divided between Pakistanis and Bangladeshis, who detest each other. And that's one reason why, in both of the main parliamentary seats in Oldham, even though they've come up for, you know, the MPs for those areas have been replaced twice in the past few years, giving the local Muslims a chance to get their man in the local Labour Party. On each occasion, the Asians failed to get their act together and get their man in, mainly because the Pakistanis and the Bangladeshis hate each other, and they hate each other a great deal more than they care about their religion or their common interest in advancing it. So that's one factor that I know about on the ground, because I know the situation in that particular town very well. Some of your listeners may remember that Oldham hit the headlines about 20 years ago because of big race riots in the town centre there. And that led to, in the days when I was in the BNP there, that led to the BNP making a big electoral breakthrough very briefly in that area. But it illustrates the differences on the ground within some of our towns and cities. The bigger difference, of course, worldwide, the whole Sunni Shia thing, that's a theological thing as well as a cultural thing, is less of an issue in Britain, simply because most of the Muslims in Britain, outside London at any rate, are Sunni Muslims of one sort or another. But that's another topic that we may get into later on. But in terms of political reality, the difference is very often, A, between Pakistanis and Bangladeshis, and secondly, it can even come down to which particular clan you're part of within Pakistan. Internal mosque politics in towns like Blackburn can be affected by that.
Well, Peter, let me ask you this with regards to ethnicity versus religion and so on and so forth. This is a rejoinder, but it will take us in a slightly different direction as well. Let's talk about what I call soccer nationalism. Soccer, or football, as you call it over there, is a religion in Britain, and there have long been signs of racial consciousness among some fans, even while those running the sport put anti-racism signs all over the stadiums and TV screens. But do you feel that there's any hope of redirecting the loyalty of a critical mass of these fans from their local teams to the defense of their own kind?
Well, just to some extent, we have to remember Shakespeare here and say that the fault lies not in our stars but in ourselves. It's very easy to blame the sheeple, as some people often refer to white people as sheeple, or point out the weaknesses among our own people, as though the fault is entirely theirs. You know, I think we, over the years, we've made a few mistakes as a movement as well. And before we're too keen to criticize the sheeple, we should look very carefully at ourselves, in particular the way in which personal rivalries of one sort or another or the pursuit of personal glory on the part of individual leaders have taken precedence over the broader cause. Once we've got our own act together, then it might be time to start criticizing the voters. But I think to some extent Brexit was a positive sign of voters who had previously despaired of having any influence, and you can understand why they despaired, actually thinking that now they had a chance to do something. Now, whether Brexit itself will ultimately provide much of an answer is a different question. I want to focus on the mere fact that it raised hope. We had Land of Hope and Glory earlier on. Well, Brexit represented hope. It might not yet represent glory, but it did represent hope for a lot of ordinary voters, who many of whom hadn't even bothered to vote in normal elections over the years. And in a lot of those areas, the type of people you're talking about, who might go to the football but not bother to vote, they got out of their armchairs, they went along and voted in vast numbers Brexit.
Now, sounds like the Trump phenomenon we had over here, actually, Peter.
Yes, the Trump. Well, and I actually want to ask Peter, my goodness, Peter, just like with Adrian Davis, there's something so interesting about the UK, I think, with it being the mother country, that we have such a bit more vested interest in the goings-on over there than we do in some of our other European nations, although we still have cousins and kinsmen there as well, and that's why we're making all of these stops. But time is going by very quickly. We'll be back with Peter Rushton right after this.
Proclaiming liberty across the land. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA Radio News with Dan Naraki.
Stimulus money is on its way, according to the Treasury Department. Americans could begin seeing their payments when the latest COVID relief bill hit their bank account as early as this weekend. The Internal Revenue Service says that people can begin to check on the status of their payments starting Monday on their website. The first round of those payments will be sent out via direct deposit, with paper checks and debit cards being mailed out later this month. And as vaccination efforts continue to ramp up across the country, more than 101 million doses of coronavirus vaccine have been administered in the U.S., with nearly 20% of the country having received at least one dose. About 2.3 million shots a day are being administered, with that number expected to quickly increase as more states expand eligibility for the vaccine, with Michigan the latest state to announce an expansion. All Michigan residents 16 and older will be eligible for the shot starting on April the 5th. This is USA Radio News.
Rockstar Radio. Did you know this station, this network, is looking for their next rockstar broadcaster? That's right, we are. And it could be you. It could be you interviewing the guests, talking to the newsmakers right in the middle of everything. Have you ever dreamed of being a rockstar show host? Now could be your chance. Together with this station, we'll help you with everything you need. The studios, the equipment, your own producer, a co-host if you'd like, and so much more. Broadcasting is changing. There's never been a need for fresh voices and unique opinions like there is right now. You can do this. Our professional team will guide you every step of the way. Sound effects, show content, building your social network media, and everything you need to be the next rockstar broadcaster. Get all the details. Email Bill at rockstar.today. That's Bill at rockstar.today. To get started with your own show, email Bill at rockstar.today. That's Bill at rockstar.today. Don't wait. You could be the next voice for America. Email Bill at rockstar.today.
Calls for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's resignation in the wake of multiple scandals continue to increase. Wendy King has the latest from the USA Radio News Pacific Northwest Bureau.
Senators Kirsten Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer became the latest members of New York's congressional delegation to call on Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign over several accusations of sexual misconduct and harassment. They joined the majority of the state's members in the House in the growing tide of lawmakers that are urging the defiant governor to step down. Cuomo repeated his denial of the allegations on Friday and said he would not resign. Earlier, Congressman Jerry Nadler, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, said Cuomo had lost the confidence of New Yorkers. He is also under fire for the misconduct allegations and a scandal on his failure to report nursing home deaths connected with COVID-19. The New York State Assembly has now opened an impeachment investigation. From the USA Radio News Pacific Northwest Bureau, I'm Wendy King.
This is USA Radio News.
I know what you're saying, ladies and gentlemen. I know what you're saying. It's only March. It's way too early to be playing Christmas music, but let me fill you in on a little bit of history. Popular legend attributes that song as being written by Henry VIII for Anne Boleyn, one of the women he would ultimately marry and execute. It was called Greensleeves back then. Now, some historians say that that association is erroneous. And that song most likely originated during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, the
probably
daughter.
Probably written by a black person. Maybe Meghan Markle.
The daughter of Henry and Anne. But it goes back to the Tudor era nonetheless, and it was such a popular song that it has been repurposed, lyrics added to it, such as the famous Christmas carol, What Child Is This? But that brings the question, Peter. I don't want to spend too much time on Trivial Pursuits, but when we had our friend Adrian on last week, I believe it was just before the Oprah Winfrey interview aired in the UK. I didn't watch it. This Oprah as the oppressed billionaire going up against the two oppressed
I did watch
royals,
it,
and but it was just revealing of their stupendous narcissism that in the middle of what we are told is a pandemic, that they sought to steal the spotlight to whine about how hard it is to be a member of the super elite. Disgusting and embarrassing, Harry, the living embodiment of everything a man should try strive not to be, weak, disloyal, and subservient to an ungrateful shrew who despises him. But the reason I bring it up is, well, two reasons. Number one, I want to ask you this, though. What has been the response by the citizens of the UK? Have they focused their angst on the royal family, or, you know, or has it been directed to where it should be, at Harry and Meghan?
Well, so far, there's an interesting division in British public opinion. There's the minority of the ultra-woke, led by sections of the political establishment, who are keen as ever to whine on about racism. But so far as we can tell, the vast majority of ordinary Britons are scandalized at the sheer brass neck, as they'd say over here, of this woman, who marries into the royal family and then turns her back on all the duties that go along with it, who wants privilege without duty, and who seems to have adopted the very worst of the 21st century me attitude, as was seen on the excerpts from that program that I've seen, and so I think what could be happening here is that it's another example of the woke minority overrating their own influence, overrating themselves as individuals, and overrating their political power. And another example of that, of course, is this is all this nonsense that we hear all over the place now about trans rights. That I noticed in up in my own area in Manchester, the university in Manchester now is advising staff they shouldn't use the word mother. The word mother is now.
I saw that. Yeah.
You know, it's not many years ago. Offensive words meant things like the N word. You know, now it's the M word. The word mother is offensive to trans people, and of course this in a way relates to racial issues, because it's another example of the woke minority being in denial about biological reality. They've been in denial about biological reality in respect of race. Now they're in denial about the basics of biological reproduction itself. Now, surely this is sort of an example. Back in the days of the French Revolution, an anti-revolutionary commentator in France said that, like Saturn, he was referring to the Roman god Saturn, the revolution eats its children. And in a sense, the woke revolution is eating its children, you know. This is a great sign of hope for us, because after all, what do we stand for? We stand for biological reality. We stand for truth. We're not promoting some weird cult. We are promoting what would have been regarded by every generation of white people until very recently as fundamental common sense. And the worse that the more that the Meghan types and all of her acolytes and all the trans lobby and all of their acolytes, the more they go on about themselves and promote themselves and go on about how offended they are by everyone else. This is surely provoking a fundamental rethink, or should, among our people about the whole direction of social attitudes in recent decades across the West.
Yeah, Peter, this is Keith again. Let me just say this. We've always said here in the South, the American South, that the race issue was a camel's nose in the tent. And once the camel's nose is in the tent, as the Arabs know, it's not long before the camel owns the tent and you've been moved out of your tent. And let me just ask you about the situation that is going on with Meghan Markle. Here is a B-list actress who specializes...
Well, you're being generous with that.
Yeah, B-list actress that specializes in soft porn somehow gets to be the Duchess of Sussex or whatever, and part of the royal family, and immediately turns on him. I think that was her plan to begin with. And they're showing now, they're flexing their muscles. They apparently think that the charge of racism is so strong, toxic, virulent, whatever you want to call it, that they can bring down the House of Windsor with it. You know, what is that? What's going on over there? And, you know, it's a major embarrassment to the historic nation of Britain, you know, that they have a black American princess before they have a Cockney princess. You know, what is, you know, the people of England.
Hey, but Peter, before you answer that, let me read this to you, because we have about 2 minutes remaining in this segment, and you can try to just cram it all in before we go to the next break. Gregory Hood of Jared Taylor's American Renaissance wrote this week in response to the topic we're covering this segment. Even we colonials are fascinated by the British royal family. The monarchy is seductive, and it's a temptation to defend it when the leftists attack it. But the way forward is not modernization, but rather restoration. Start by stripping Prince Harry of his title and letting him stay on as the house husband of a voice actor. Don't take him back when she leaves him, as she surely will. The crown should become a unifying symbol of the Anglosphere by defending the Church of England, British culture, and the accomplishments of Anglo-Saxons everywhere. Andrew Fraser, who was our guest last week during this series, proposed such a solution in The Wasp Question, his book. A post-Brexit United Kingdom could retain relevance by strengthening ties with the white nations it created, with the monarchs as the unifying symbol. Do you see, Peter, any hope for a monarchy going forward in any timeline in history going forward where it could be of service to...
Yeah, last week during this segment, we played the Sex Pistols' God Save the Queen. Because
the monarchy be... be something we could use going forward, or is it just completely corrupted to the point of absurdity?
Unfortunately, for decades, the monarchy has stood for the precise opposite of what you were speaking about there. The monarchy has stood for transforming the empire and the Commonwealth into a multiracial Britain. There is, however, just a chance that sanity might prevail now, simply because this Meghan episode, this Meghan Markle episode, has illustrated the sheer absurdity of continuing to be surrendering, of white Britons, white people throughout the world, continually giving way, continually surrendering. Because the simple answer is, you can never surrender enough. You can never demean yourself enough. You can start every football match kneeling in obeisance to George Floyd. That's never enough. You can, and the Meghan episode has illustrated that very, very clearly. The question is whether people in royal circles can stand up and draw the line now and say, this is enough. We have to redefine monarchy as a symbol of the nation, as a symbol of the of British culture and the British diaspora, as you might say, around the white world.
We call that the Anglosphere. Unfortunately, Prince Charles is probably the biggest liberal twit in Great Britain at this time.
I don't know. That would probably be... Well, yeah, Harry's over. Where's Harry? I don't even know. They're like in Oregon or Vancouver now, or so. I don't know where they live.
I don't know where they are, but...
Are they still being... Peter, are they still being subsidized by the British taxpayer?
I don't believe so. Are they?
Well, to some extent, there was a payoff, and we're not quite certain exactly how much they're still getting, but there was an agreement and a payoff at the end. Now, of course, they've Netflix money, they've got Oprah's money, they've got money from, presumably, they've got money from the people related to the people who promoted that marriage in the first place, because it's a very interesting question as to who in Meghan Markle's circle, in the matchmaker, as you might say, in that circle, promoted the idea.
I thought she just put something on in the granny's eye soap can wash.
All right, hold on, everybody. Hold on. Peter Rushton, heritageanddestiny.com. We'll be back with him right after this.
Scott Bradley here. Most Americans are painfully aware that the nation is on the wrong track and in dire straits. Unfortunately, most political pundits only nibble around the edges when they claim to address the issues. Even worse, many of the so-called solutions are simply rewarmed servings of what got us into the mess we currently face. And the politicians think we're so gullible and naive that we'll buy their lies that they have reformed and now understand where they led us astray. Unfortunately, the truth of the matter is that they simply wish to continue to hold power. The solution to America's challenges is found in returning to the timeless principles found in the United States Constitution. My book and lecture series will reawaken in Americans an understanding and love of the principles which made this nation the freest, most prosperous, happiest, and most respected nation on earth. Visit topreservethenation.com. and order my book and lectures to begin the restoration of this great nation.
Okay, girls, about finished with your lesson on money?
Daddy, what is a buy-sell spread for gold coins?
Well, when you sell a gold coin to a coin shop that's worth, say, $1,200, you don't actually get $1,200. But don't worry, we're members of UPMA now, so we don't have to worry about that.
Daddy, what if somebody steals our gold?
We don't have any gold at the house. It's stored safely in the UPMA vault, securely and insured.
But the S&P 500 outperformed gold. Daddy, gold is a bad investment.
Some people do think of it that way. But actually, gold is money. And as members of the United Precious Metals Association, we can use our gold at any store, just like a credit card. Or I can ask them to drop it right into Mommy and Daddy's bank account, because we're a UPMA member family. Find out more at upma.org. That's upma.org.
Why don't we say to the government writ large that they have to spend a little bit less? Anybody ever had less money this year than you had last? Anybody better having a 1% pay cut? You deal with it. That's what government needs, a 1% pay cut. If you take a 1% pay cut across the board, you have more than enough money to actually pay for the disaster relief. But nobody's going to do that because they're fiscally irresponsible. Who are they? Republicans. Who are they? Democrats. Who are they? Virtually the whole body is careless and reckless with your money. So the money will not be offset by cuts anywhere. The money will be added to the debt, and there will be a day of reckoning. What's the day of reckoning? The day of reckoning may well be the collapse of the stock market. The day of reckoning may be the collapse of the dollar. When it comes, I can't tell you exactly, but I can tell you it has happened repeatedly in history when countries ruin their currency.
When you think about it, ladies and gentlemen, the Tudor dynasty gave us so much. What Child Is This? Bloody Mary, Henry VIII, that classic from Herman's Hermits. You know, I named my child Henry. My son is named Henry, and there is a connection there, I'll tell you. But I am really enjoying our march around the world. This it's not that we are bringing to you the most thoughtful leaders that we could give you. It is we are bringing to you the most thoughtful leaders that there are out there, period, end of story. And it is a great honor tonight to have with us Peter Rushton of Heritage and Destiny, heritageanddestiny.com. And, of course, if you're talking about the founding stock of the American experiment, we came from what is now known as the UK, predominantly England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, Northern Ireland. So we do have a little extra fascination with that, even though our salvation may lie in the east with Hungary and Croatia and Russia. We'll see where it goes. But nevertheless, let's get back to Peter Rushton now. Peter, we have some questions that I'd like to get to you with in short order. You've been a fascinating guest, and this is another one of those interviews that we could go for 2 hours very easily and still not cover it all. But let me ask you, if I could, about Nigel Farage, who just announced his retirement recently from active politics. Was he a net gain or loss for white Britain? Or was he like Thatcher and Trump, consciously or not, a means of diffusing and distracting genuine fight back?
Well, look, Nigel Farage was not a racial nationalist and his politics were not mine. However, I think it's appropriate at this stage to pay tribute to the work that Farage did in spearheading this Brexit cause and, as I was saying earlier, giving hope to Britons, to ordinary Britons. Now, the Brexit referendum and what Farage did was not an end in itself. It's the beginning of a process. It's the beginning of a process of British awakening. But Farage made an immense contribution to that because without him, the pro-Brexit cause, UKIP and all of that would have been fissiparous. It would have been squabbling factions on a committee. Farage was the one man who was able to knit all of that together, not from an ideological standpoint anywhere near mine, but nonetheless in actually doing something. And, you know, it's up to the rest of us who have a different outlook, a more racially conscious outlook than Farage, a different outlook on foreign policy, a different outlook on all sorts of other things. It's up to us to build on that, to build on that awakening, to build on those foundations that Farage was able to give us.
All right. That is certainly a comprehensive answer on that question. Now, let me ask you this. How deep does the reckoning have to go for us to reclaim our nations? This actual question came in from a listener, so let me read it verbatim. Can you save white England without dealing with the Rothschilds Bank, et al., et cetera?
Well, for one thing, we have to bear in mind that England has only been in this multiracial experiment since shortly after the Second World War. So for us, the situation is not quite so deep-seated historically as it is for the USA, for example, the racial situation. If you go back more than 70 years or so, mm-hmm. England was essentially a white country. So it's just about within living memory. And that, of course, is one reason why historical dramas and even Shakespeare plays, all sorts of things, have to be cast now by inserting black actors in a quite ahistorical manner.
Yes.
Because the establishment are trying to create
fake
history. Because they're fully aware of the fact that multiracialism...
No, I was just going to say, I'm waiting for the day when Jeremy Irons is cast as Martin Luther King in a biopic, but no, continue.
Well, yeah, that's right, yeah. I think we'll have to wait a long time for that. But it's the shallow roots of that multiracial experiment are, I think, what the establishment are still concerned about. So it's not a completely done deal. It could be argued that we've got to address aspects of our own history, address why did this multiracial disaster come to Europe just after the Second World War, address aspects of Britain's own history, Britain's decision to take part in that war. But Pat Buchanan, for example, in his excellent book on Churchill and the Unnecessary War, as he called it, that's an important topic, I think, one of the many metapolitical topics that need to be addressed for British people to escape from the trap of thinking that multiracialism was somehow inevitable or that resisting it in any way is somehow evil. We do need to get to some of the historical and cultural fundamentals, as well as, you know, your question was referring to economic fundamentals, but there are a number of fundamental issues that have to be addressed if we're going to break that spell. But the mere fact that it's,
you know, Peter, we have interviewed Pat Buchanan on this show about that exact book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. That's the title of the book. And Pat's been on this show a few times. One of the greatest hours of this program was interviewing him on that particular book, and it is a great one. Thank you for speaking it, Keith.
Well, actually, I think that both wars, World War I and World War II, were unnecessary wars for England had they sat them out. One, I think that the Western Front in both wars would have been a replay of the Franco-Prussian War. And secondly, England would not have depleted its ranks of the best and brightest young men, and they would have emerged as the leader of England, of Europe, rather than... it's ironic that Churchill's dream of England remaining the top dog nation in Europe was undermined precisely by his actions, getting them involved in both world wars.
I think that we could all agree, and I don't want to go back into a historical accounting right now, but obviously all the participants in World War II lost that war. I was watching a movie about Stalingrad recently. I mean, it was just the most
except
horrific,
for international jury.
Well, but they weren't necessarily participants either.
Well, they were. They
well,
know.
Not on the ground. But anyway, Stalingrad, I mean, the most horrific battle perhaps in human history. And no, I mean, you talk about the best and the brightest were lost in the UK and Germany. I mean, my goodness, what a devastating. And, you know, we lost the best and the brightest on both sides, and it's been filled, that vacuum has been filled by the weak and the incompetent and the apologetic and not the strong.
But see, the thing is, James, on this, let me just interject on
very,
this.
Very, very quickly.
It would not have been that long meat grinder killing machine, both in World War I and World War II, that it became had it not been for England inserting itself unnecessarily into both wars.
All right, well, that may well be the case, but let's give the last 2 minutes to our featured guest, Peter Rushton. Be sure to check out his work at heritageanddestiny.com. Peter, it has been such a privilege to host you this hour. It's been another hour that's gone by far too quickly. But my last 2 minutes this hour are yours. What have we not covered that you would like to express to the audience? What issues concerning the UK do you think my American audience most needs to hear that we have not yet been able to ask you? The floor is yours. Take it any direction you'd like.
Thank you very much, James. Well, just to finish off, in relation to what we were just talking about there, in a way, the establishment is determined to curtail free discussion, not just on racial issues, but on some of the historical topics that we were all referring to a moment ago. And I had experience of that just last year, but also experience of how there is still hope in the midst of this repression. Because I was involved alongside my friend Lady Michelle Renouf in her criminal trial in Germany, where she had spoken. She'd made an impromptu speech in Dresden, in the historic city of Dresden, in February 2018, where she'd been touching on some of these very topics of the unnecessary war, of the terrible war crime, of the bombing of Dresden, and touching on the historical background of that and other questions. And she was arrested by the German police in the middle of her speech, and for 2.5 years was facing criminal charges. A lot of the background on this, I've now put a blog spot up about this, that particular case, that trial, called modeltrial.blogspot.com. That's Model Trial, M-O-D-E-L-T-R-I-A-A-L. blogspot.com, because at the end of 2.5 years, and this is the sign of hope that I want to leave your listeners with, despite the terrible laws that exist in Germany, the courts in Dresden were afraid, for reasons that we're continuing to explore on that blog, they were afraid to take Michelle to trial because they were afraid of the truths that would be exposed in the witness box. That is one example, one extraordinary example of how in Germany our opponents are afraid of the truth. In Britain, our opponents are afraid of the truth on a whole range of issues that we've been discussing today, and right across the white world, they're afraid of the truth. One reason
she's
despairing is that truth is on our side.
It is on our side. I was talking with Sam Dixon about this on Thursday night as I was driving around town running errands. The sheer gravity will collapse on this woke movement. Our side will prevail. When? That's the question. Thank you for speaking the name Michelle Renouf. Lady Michelle, she and I shared the podium at a speaking event many, many years ago. Great lady. Great man, Peter Rushton, HeritageAndDestiny.com. Thank you so much. We'll be back with the second hour right after this.